God, we invite you into this room to guide and direct each of us as we seek your truth. Father, please set aside within each of us that which would block us off from the truth. Lay aside our prejudices about what we think we know about this process, this meeting, and our spiritual condition. Remove our fears, Lord, that we may hear your truth through the members of this group. Give us strength and courage to share your truth with each other in the real spirit of love and compassion to our fellow man. Amen.
Amen.
Now it's my great pleasure to turn this meeting back over to Don Brown and Mike McKissick.
Mike's going to start. I'm always amazed that anybody even comes back, but that's good. We've been fortunate this morning, and a number of people have. I like this when people get fired up enough to share what they have. We have two people in the room that brought in first edition books, and it was Mike knew about it, but it's the first time that you'll ever see the doctor's opinion with number one instead of a numeral, whatever they call it, Roman numeral. So the two books, if you'll hold up your hands, they're willing to have you look at them and share them. They come out of Works Publishing Company, which was the original company of Bill before AA owned it. And they're interesting to look at. And one of them has Bill Wilson's signature in it. So that's, and there's a story behind all of that and how he got that. So they're willing to share with you, and I know they don't want your fingerprints on it, so they're nice books. Keep them. They're worth a little money today. You ready, Mike?
I'm ready.
All right.
Morning. I want to check with the gentleman in the back. Can everybody hear me in the back? Somehow yesterday it was conveyed to me that I wasn't speaking loud enough. I'm perfectly capable of speaking louder, but I just assumed move the microphone. Chapter 3 today. We're going to start at Chapter 3. We've done the doctor, we've done the prefaces, the doctor's opinion, Bill's story. But there is a solution. And it's been going all the way through the book. Bill keeps going back to we're working on the first 60 pages to try to get to where we can make a decision. So we're going to talk about one, powerlessness. Two, that I'm going to find a solution, a power greater than myself. And so Chapter 3 is just going to be reinforcing that, and he's going to start dropping the hammer a little harder here in Chapter 3. There's more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. No lie. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellow. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. I don't just want to control my drinking. I want to go back to where it's an enjoyable experience. You know, the obsession I have is that somehow I can find that sense of ease and comfort that I found the first time that I took a drink. Or that in the first few years of my drinking. You know, that's my obsession. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. See, I live in an illusion. The illusion is that somehow I'm going to satisfy the obsession. You know, and in this first paragraph he uses illusion and delusion and obsession. You know, the amazing thing is that I am perfectly capable of living in a delusion. I can lie to myself and believe it. That's what I do. I tell myself a lie and I believe it. So it comes into what really is the first step question again. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. You see, nobody else can ever tell me that I'm an alcoholic. A lot of people try. Wives tried, judges tried, bosses tried, my children tried. Maybe if you went to church, somebody at the church tried, my doctor tried. No. And it's never going to happen until I have to do one thing, concede to my innermost self. I've got to diagnose myself as an alcoholic. I've got to understand that I'm powerless, I'm unmanageable, I'm insane, and I'm abnormal. That is the acceptance. That is the surrender that Bill's talking about here. See, it says the delusion that we are like other people, or presently may be, has to be smashed. Right? I tell myself a lie. I'm like everybody else. Everybody else would like to be like me. They'd like to be out drinking every day, all day long, just because, you know, I think that's normal. So I tell myself that lie, I believe it. And it's not the delusion that I would live in what he says in this line, I love it. It doesn't say that the delusion that we can drink like other people. It says that we are like other people. It's everything about me is delusional. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost their ability to control a drink. We know that no real alcoholic ever, italicized word, recovers control. Goes back to the doctor's opinion. What is it that makes us all alike? We can't control a drink. We all have that in common. No matter what the kind of a drunk we are, however else we want to define ourselves. All of us felt at times that we were gaining control. But such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Is that an experience that all of us have had? You see, I've got to find the bottom here. I've got to find a bottom that is my bottom. I've got to know in my innermost self that I'm hopeless. You know, the word that the book doesn't use often is surrender, you know, because alcoholics don't like to hear that word. I don't want to surrender. It's like I don't want to be insane, and I don't want to be abnormal, and I don't want to be, you know, unmanageable. But I have to see that truth. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. See, and this is, and Bill talks here about our type, and he talks again about our type. You know, and it's all right sometimes, and I had a lot of questions in the, last night and again this morning about, well, what about this kind of sponsee or that kind of sponsee? And you know, it's like, wow, you know, that's why you got the book. I can read in the book, and I know what an alcoholic of our type is. I'm not going to tell you, if you come to me to sponsor you, I'm not going to tell you what kind of an alcoholic you are. It doesn't matter to me. If you're of our type, this is the solution. If you're not, you can define yourself and be some other type. It didn't work for me. I tried for 36 years to be somebody else other than a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. In the end, at the bottom, at the point of surrender, it was the only door left. There was no place else to go. We are like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there have been brief recovery, followed always by still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. I keep pursuing that illusion. I keep telling that lie. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. And somebody said to me one time, they said, well, you know, if they got a pill that made you drink like a normal person, you know, what would you do? And I thought, well, I think I'd take that pill. And then I thought, wait a second. I've seen normal people drink. I don't want to drink like a normal person. You know, I'm abnormal and insane. And an abnormal and insane person doesn't want to be like a normal person. So, you know, I don't want to be there. You know, if I can't go where I want to go, I'm not going to go at all. You know. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe that they are in this class. I understand that. Once again, the conversation. You know, when you start working with somebody and they start sponsoring and they're not a real alcoholic and they want to argue the idiosyncrasies of which type that they are, that's all well and good, but it's a, you know, it's an intellectual exercise of no consequence when it comes to this program. By every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Here are some of the methods we've tried. Anybody didn't do one of these, then we'll talk about it. Drinking beer only. Limiting the drink number of drinks. Never drinking alone. Never drinking in the morning. Drinking only at home. Never having it in the house. Never drinking during business hours. Drinking only at parties. Switching from scotch to brandy. Drinking only natural wines. Agreeing to resign if ever drunk on the job. Taking a trip. Not taking a trip. Swearing off forever with or without a solemn oath. Taking more physical exercise. Reading inspirational books. Going to health forums and sanitariums, detoxes, therapy, hospitals, accepting volunteer. They didn't have it. Health forums and sanitariums were the only solution in 1937 when the book was written. Now we can like make that list go forever. You know, what do I want to do? I don't want to be an alcoholic, but I got a detox, so I'll go to the detox. You know, I'll check in there. 28-day program, spin dry, I'm out and running. You know, I'm healed. You know, if I do that about 8 times, maybe it'll stick. We could increase the list ad infinitum. Because we do not like to pronounce individual as an alcoholic, but you can quickly diagnose yourself. Self-diagnose. The only way I'm going to believe it. Well, I can quit lying to myself and believe it. Step over to the, I love this, tell this to my guys all the time. Step over to the nearest bar room and try some controlled drinking. Try to drink and stop abruptly. And then I always say, because I always got the smart ass guy that says, well, I just yesterday I had 2 beers and I was fine. I said, then I say, oh, and that's what it says then. And the book says then, try it more than once. It will not take long for you to decide, if you were honest with yourself about it, it may be worth a bad case of jitters to find jitters if you get a full knowledge of your condition. Okay? As a sponsor, I'm not defining what you are. I have no idea what you are. You got to diagnose yourself. You know, I'd be glad to offer you some hints. But it's pretty clear in the book, if you can do these things, that's what you're supposed to be doing. Though there's no way of proving it, we believe that early in our drinking careers, most of us could have stopped drinking. But the difficulty is that few alcoholics have enough desire to stop while there is yet time. We have heard of a few instances where people who showed definite signs of alcoholism were able to stop for a long period because of an overpowering desire to do so. Here is one. Now, what's going to happen here is Bill is going to now give us 4 examples of the insanity, of the delusion, of what happens in our head, you know. Because what's going to happen here is I always have to drink on a lot. I can't go drinking. I never once walked in the bar and said, I'd like 3 shots of tequila and please call the sheriff because in about 20 minutes I'm going to smash your bar up. I never once did that. I never once went to the liquor store and I'd say, I'd like a 5th of scotch and would you, you know, call my wife and tell her to call the divorce attorney. No. Never did I have the intention that today I'm going to go to jail. You know. I'll tell you what. Let's get a little, you know, let's get drunk, decide we need some drugs, drive over to Richmond and get stabbed. What do you think? It's going to be a swell day. I can't drink or use on the truth. If I tell myself the truth, you know, I won't do it. So Bill's going to give us four examples. And he starts out with a man of 30 who was doing a great deal of spree drinking. He was very nervous in the morning after these bouts. He quieted himself with more liquor. I understand that. He was ambitious to succeed in business. He saw that he could get nowhere if he drank at all. Once he started, he had no control whatever. He made up his mind that until he had been successful in business and had retired, he would not touch another drop. Exceptional man, he remained bone dry for 25 years and retired at the age of 55 after a successful and happy business career. Then he fell victim to the belief, which practically every alcoholic has, that his long period of sobriety, mine was usually like 10 to 12 days, of self-discipline had qualified him to drink as other men. Out came his carpet slippers and a bottle. In 2 months, he was in the hospital, puzzled and humiliated. He tried to regulate his drinking for a while, making several trips to the hospital in the meantime. Then, gathering all his forces, he attempted to stop altogether, and found he could not. Every means of solving this problem with money, which money could buy, was at his disposal. Every attempt failed. Though a robust man in retirement, he went to pieces quickly and was dead within 4 years. This case contains a powerful lesson. Most of us have believed that if we remain sober for a long stretch, we could thereafter drink normally. Is that the lie? That's the lie. I want to believe that lie. I've tried that lie out over my 36-year career countless times. Give me 30 days, give me 10 days, give me a year or one. So it says, but here is a man who at 55 years found he was just where he had left off at 30. We have seen the truth demonstrated again and again. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Commencing to drink after a period of sobriety, we are in short time as bad as ever. If we are planning to stop drinking, there must be no reservation of any kind, no lurking notion that someday we will be immune to alcohol. Young people may be encouraged by this man's experience to think that they can stop as he did on their own willpower. We doubt if many of them can do it because none will really want to stop, and hardly one of them, because of the peculiar mental twist already acquired, will find he can win out. Several of our crowd, men of 30 or less, have been drinking only a few years, but they found themselves as helpless as those who had been drinking 20 years. To be gravely affected, one does not necessarily have to drink a long dime nor take the quantity some of us have. This is particularly true of women. Potential female alcoholics often turn to the real thing and are gone beyond recall in a few years. Certain drinkers who would be greatly insulted if called alcoholics are astonished at their inability to stop. We who are familiar with the symptoms see large numbers of potential alcoholics among young people everywhere, but try and get them to see it. As we look back, we feel we have gone on drinking many years beyond the point where we could quit on our willpower. If anyone questions whether he has entered this dangerous era, let him try leaving liquor alone for a year. Like I said yesterday, that was the line I seized on 20 years into my drinking career. And actually stayed bone dry for 1 year, white knuckled, so I could keep my wife and family, satisfy everybody that I wasn't an alcoholic, because it said in their book, and I wasn't one of them, that if I could leave liquor alone for 1 year, if he's a real alcoholic and very far advanced, there's a scant chance of success. Well, let's see. Will I quit drinking forever, or will I suffer this pain for 1 year so that I can go back to what I really want to do? Not a problem. And what I could really do is, for that 1 year, make your life more miserable to be around me than when I was drinking. So that when the 1 year is up, you're going to be rolling bottles into the room. That was exactly the case. And I want to tell you, one of the other things that kept me out was my father, who was a raging alcoholic, 6 years before he passed away, decided that somehow, in some delusional state, that he had had enough and went to a aversion therapy center, Wally Hill Aversion Therapy Center, and actually dried out. And for 6 years, it was dried out. And I was still drinking then, and I'm watching him, and I'm going, listen, if this is how you're going to be after you stop, then I'm never going to stop. And he died much worse and much unhappier and much more miserable, dry, than he went from. In the early days of our drinking, we occasionally remained sober for a year or more, becoming serious drinkers again later. Though you may be able to stop for a considerable period, you may yet be a potential alcoholic. We think few to whom this book will appeal can stay dry anything like a year. Some will be drunk a day after making their resolution. Most of them within a few weeks. For those who are unable to drink moderately, the question is how to stop altogether. We are assuming, of course, that the reader desires to stop. Another question this morning. What do you do about your guys that keep going out? They come to you as a sponsor. They keep going out. You say, fine, it's not a problem. Come back when you're ready. I can't do anything to make you. You have to desire to stop. Whether such a person could point upon a non-spiritual basis depends upon the extent to which he has already lost the power to choose whether he will drink or not. Many of us felt that we had plenty of character. There was a tremendous urge to cease forever, yet we found it impossible. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it. It's this utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the will. I am powerless. How shall we help our readers determine to their own satisfaction whether they are one of us? The experiment of quitting for a period of time will be helpful, but we think we can render even greater service to alcoholic sufferers and perhaps to the medical fraternity. So we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking, for obviously this is the crux of the problem. What sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? That's a question. I think the word is insanity. Friends who have reasoned with him after a spree which has brought him to the point of divorce or bankruptcy are mystified when he walks directly into a saloon. Why does he? Of what is he thinking? So example number two, then. Our first example, he says it's our first example, but I count the guy that quit for 25 years. But the first example is a friend we should call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He had a commendable World War record. He was a good salesman. Everybody liked him. He was an intelligent man, normal so far as we can see, except for a nervous disposition. Nervous disposition. He did no drinking until he was 35. In a few years, he became so violent and intoxicated he had to be committed. On leaving the asylum, he came into contact with us. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. Step one. And the answer. Step two. This is going to be an interesting book study. Okay, so Jim comes out of the asylum. He comes to AA. And what happened? We told him what we knew about alcoholism. Powerless. Life's unmanageable. Step one. And the answer we found. Step two. Came to believe power greater than myself. He made a beginning. What's the beginning? Step three. So these guys got Jim to a third step. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge his spiritual life. I think, you know, I told the 12-pill story last night. I won't tell it again today, but, you know, he stops at three. He fails to do the rest of the steps. Right? Failed to enlarge his spiritual life. To his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. On each of the occasions we worked with him, this guy's a persistent sponsor. Hey, I'm going out, I'm coming back. Six times. Six times, I tell you. You do one, two, three. Six times, I go out. Six times, I come back. And we reviewed carefully what had happened. He agreed. He was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had deep affection. So it says we reviewed everything. It doesn't say he ever did anything again, then, does it? Right? How many of you guys go to meetings? You know, people that are like, can't get past three. I'm going to make a decision, but I'm going to sit in this meeting until the osmosis works. You know? There's an expression, though. I'll use it now because what I do is what I find in a lot of meetings now is people come in and they read the promise. They work the promises and they're waiting for the steps to happen. You know, I don't work the steps and get the promises. I come in and the promises are on the wall, or I'm reading at the meeting and they're in the middle of the ninth step. But you know what? That's not what I hear. I hear, wow, this is it. And I'm just going to sit here with all these cool people that are all like abnormal like me, and I'm going to like get the solution. So, he has a deep affection. And then it says, yet he got drunk again. We ask him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. Well, finally got him to tell his story. He says, am I in your way, Bill? It says, I came to work on Tuesday morning. I always love Joe and Charlie. Somebody always pipes up and says, what happened on Monday? Come to work on Tuesday. But he's a car salesman. Yeah, you know, he might have had to work the weekend. He says, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. Am I irritated that I have to work for a concern that I once owned? I had a few words with the boss, but nothing serious. This is the guy that now owns a company that I used to own that I don't like, and I'm having not serious few words with him. And I'm a little irritated. Then I decide, I kind of feel a resentment here. You know, just a little one, though. Then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. I don't know how they sold cars in 1937, but it's different than they do today. On the way, I felt so hungry. I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. I had no intention of drinking. I just thought I had to get a sandwich. I also had the notion that I might find a customer for a car in this place, which was familiar, for I'd been going to it for years. I'd eaten there many times during the months. Once I was sober, I sat down at a table, ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. Boy is hungry. And then the lie. Suddenly the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach. I ordered a whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured that as I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. The experiment so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it into the milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. Okay, I'm going to do an experiment. What's the lie? See? I can't drink on the truth. I got to tell myself everything's not too bad in my life. Life's going okay. I'm going to go sell a car to somebody. And oh, by the way, I'm going to stop and have a drink in the bar. And then the lie is, wow, I'm pulling myself a lie this far. Why don't we go to cheese? On a full stomach and a glass of milk, the whiskey's not going to hurt me. See? This guy just relapsed six times and everybody had drummed into his head that he couldn't have a drink. So I got to, you know, what used to be a reasonable lie was, you know, I just don't feel good today, so I deserve a drink. Now I can talk this great news story. Thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic. He'd done 1, 2, and 3. He understood powerlessness. He understood that it was a solution. Yet all reasons for not drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if he only mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? You may think this is an extreme case. To us, it is not far-fetched, for this kind of thinking has been characteristic of every single one of us. We have sometimes reflected more than Jim did upon the consequences, but there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning. But there was always the curious mental phenomenon that parallel with our sound reasoning that was inevitably ran some insanely trivial excuse for taking the first drink. Our sound reasoning failed to hold us in check. The insane idea won out. Next day, we could ask ourselves, in all honesty and sincerity, how it could have happened. In some circumstances, we've gone out deliberately to get drunk, feeling ourselves justified by nervousness, anger, worry, depression, jealousy, or the like. But even in this type of beginning, we were obliged to admit that our justification for a spree was insanely insufficient in light of what always happened. We now see that when we begin to drink deliberately instead of causally, there was little serious or effective thought during the period of premeditation of what the terrific consequences would be. I cannot drink on the truth. Insanity number 3. Our behavior is absurd and incomprehensible with respect to the first drink as to that of the individual with a passion for, say, jaywalking. Love the jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years, in spite of friendly warnings, up to a point you could label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he's slightly injured several times in succession. You would expect him, if he were normal. Let's see, I'm not that at all. To cut it out. Presently is hit again, and this time has a fractured skull. Within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He tells you he has decided to stop jaywalking for good, but in a few weeks he breaks both legs. On through the years, this conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. He tells that lie, and he believes that he's going to follow through. Honey, I promise you, I'm never going to go out and drink again. I'm never going to do this again. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce. He is held up to ridicule. He tries every known means of getting the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself up in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways. But the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? But you may think our illustration is too ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. It's strong language, but isn't it true? Some of us are thinking, yes, you tell us, yes, what you tell us is true, but it doesn't fully apply. We admitted we have some of these symptoms, but we have not gone to the extremes you fellows did, nor are we likely to, for we understand ourselves so well. Self-knowledge can help me. After what we've told us, that these... For we understand ourselves so well after what you've told us that such things cannot happen again. We have not lost everything in life through drinking, and we certainly do not intend to, thanks to the information. That may be true for certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate heavy drinkers because their brains and bodies have not been damaged as ours were. But the actual or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. This is a point we wish to emphasize and reemphasize to smash home upon our alcoholic readers, as it has been revealed to us out of bitter experience. Let us take another illustration. Fred, my favorite guy, Fred. This is my life. Fred's a partner, well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home. Is happily married and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everybody. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual. Yet he is alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in a hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he had come to the hospital to rest his nerve. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition. He made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. In spite of his character and standing, Fred would not believe himself to be an alcoholic, much less accept a spiritual remedy to his for his problem. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. Starts sounding like Jim, doesn't it? He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting that he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge would fix it. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day we were told that he was back in the hospital. This time he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, but had no excuse for drinking. The story he told was most instructive, for here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, who had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his others concerned, yet was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. I was much impressed with what you fellows said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I really appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity that precedes the first drink, but I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems, and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would be only a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on guard. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had been making too hard work of a simple matter. One day, I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased and knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought came to mind that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner. That was all, nothing more. Whoa. I ordered a cocktail in my meal. Then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me the highball would be fine before going to bed. So I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty next morning. I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York and of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital with unbearable mental and physical suffering. I can just cross and have a couple of drinks with dinner and everything will be all right. Tell myself that lie and I believe. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over the evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced the drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered that my alcoholic friends had told me how they had prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more. For what I have learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow. Two of the members of Alcoholics Anonymous came to see me. They grinned. I love that. Which I didn't like so much, and then asked me if I thought of myself alcoholic and if I was really licked this time. I had to concede both propositions. They piled on me heaps of evidence to the effect that an alcoholic mentality such as I had exhibited in Washington was a hopeless condition. They cited cases out of their own experience by the dozens. This process snuffed out the last flicker of conviction that I could do the job myself. Then they outlined the spiritual answer and program of action which 100 of them had followed successfully. Though I had been only a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. That was not easy. But the moment I made up my mind to go through with the process, surrendered, I had the curious feeling that my alcoholic condition was relieved, as in fact it proved to be. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems, not just his alcohol problems. I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the life I had lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back to it even if I could. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had felt only the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they really commence to solve their problem. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusion. One of these men, staff member of a world-renowned hospital, recently made the statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As to two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you are 100% hopeless. Apart from divine help. Had you offered yourselves as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I had been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have profound respect for the spiritual approach in cases such as yours. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. Once more, alcoholic, at certain times, has no effective mental defense against the first drink. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense comes from a higher power. I can't stay sober on human power. There is no defense that another human being can provide. I can't heal a sick mind with a sick mind. I can't go sit in the fellowship, not do the steps, and assume that somehow I'm going to find the solution. The solution's in the steps. And Don can do Whig Knox.
Thank you. Good job. I have to earn my way here somewhere. My first spot.
I'm glad to know he can't get by either. Yes, there's a lot of similarities. God bless us. It's good to know that nobody's perfect. I want to start on page 30 for just a second. At the end of this seminar, and if we have time and we get out of the message, we will have, he's going to put a microphone down. He's going to do it right. He's really a smart guy. So many of these tapes I have and things, you'll hear them ask questions, but you don't know what the question is because they didn't put it on the recording. Then you got to, it gets bad. So he's going to give you a microphone down and you can ask questions, and we'll try to help you if we can. If you have a third edition book, I'll give you all the names of all the people and their sobriety dates if you want me to. There's all kinds of stuff we don't have time for. Some of this is a little trivia I'm going to give you now before I go to Agnostic. First of all, it's the thinking before the drinking. That's what this is about, the thinking before the drinking. I can't tell the truth from the false. And going against my own experience is insane. Insanity means wholeness of mind, according to our book. Insanity is less than whole. How much less than whole? That's the question. Different than crazy. There's a difference between that and crazy. The first one he talked about here, the man who had, at 30 comes from a book that Bill, I don't know how you want, borrowed from, called The Common Sense of Drinking by Richard Peabody. That's where the story came from. And the other thing, Once an Alcoholic, Always an Alcoholic, came from the same book, The Common Sense of Drinking. You can still find that book around. Peabody movement was really our competitors for a long time, to about 1950. And then he faded, he drank, and that kind of killed the movement, and they had people over. In fact, there's doctors are referring to the Peabody people more than they were Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. Most of these stories that are quoted here can go back to the doctor's opinion and the five kinds of alcoholics he gave you. These are examples of those five kinds of alcoholics. So you can go back and look at that and say, okay, that's that example. I don't know how much this means to you. This guy, Jim, was his real name is Ralph Furlong. Thought you might like to know that. And he's from Springfield, Massachusetts. He got about 90 days of sobriety, but he wouldn't do 4 through 9. And so he came in 7 of 38, and in those days, they put you right in the book right away. So his story was another prodigal son, and you're going to find it if you look in that first edition book. That's why I'm doing this, because they brought that in. You'll find that book there on page 357 of the first edition, first printing. Now they took him out the next time they printed the book, so I don't know whether he'll be in there or not, but that's where you'd find him. This next guy over here, I just love him to death. His name is Harry Brick. And there are some tapes of Harry. Harry will drink as a trustee in 38 and 43. So he didn't stay sober. And he sued AA for a loan of money when they were looking for money to print the book. He wanted to get his money back. And he had a story, and they dropped him in the second edition, so he'll be in that book. A Different Slant was the name of that story. And it's a great story. And it's one of the finest 12-step calls you'll ever make. You can learn from this story. They're teaching you how to 12-step from the very minute the book starts. They're talking about how to 12-step people. And this one, I was so impressed because a lot of people go out. Well, I used to do a lot of wet 12-step work. Don't do so much anymore. But when a lot of people go, take your bird dog with you so you can learn. And when you go out on these things, a lot of times you think you're going to win somebody over, you know. Well, no, that's not true. But what you do is you plant a seed and you lead them to think it over a little bit. And when he talks about it, he said, if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They planted the seed, and the next time he came to in that hospital, he said, oh my God, I've got an alcoholic mind. Wonderful 12-step, man. That's doing it. That's a great move. I got a little story for you about that guy's brother. You ought to see him. He's something like a younger brother. He had a lot of trouble, and he'd run between the big book, and he'd been sober about 8 years one time. So anyway, I got a call. I told him one day, we went over to another psychiatrist, and he said, what do you think? And I said, why don't you give me 30 days of your life? Really give it to me and quit screwing around here. And so that's a lot cheaper. And he said, okay. So by this time, he was in an apartment all by himself. Nobody would talk to him. His mother didn't want him. Nobody. His girlfriend. He said, you're the only guy talking to me anyway. So I said, I want you to pray in the morning, and I want you to meditate and see if you can figure out what God wants you to do that day. In the meanwhile, that morning, I got a call from an alcoholic who goes to meetings with us who was drinking and wanted somebody to come and sing. So I called Tim, tell us a little story on his brother. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm doing what you told me to. I said, really? He said, yeah, I'm praying. And I prayed, and I'm sitting in my chair trying to wait for God to send me a message. I said, how about a wet 12-step call? And he started saying, well, I said, no, I'll be by in 10 minutes and get you. Get ready. We're going to talk to a man. I didn't give him no chance. I said, meet me out front. I don't have to come get you. So anyway, he's out there, and where do we go? We go over, we see this guy, and he's got a gallon of Vinoiset wine hanging on. He lives in a pretty nice neighborhood. He's a pretty successful guy. And he just wanted to tell us about the death of his wife, who had had who was his drinking companion, and that she finally had to give up to a new liver, and he kept letting her drink alcohol with the new liver, and of course she died from that, and they wouldn't give her another new liver. And he cried some tears, which we cried with him, and it was pretty sad. So after a while, we left our cars. I said, come on, Tim, we can go home now. So we go home. I said, how you feeling? He said, I feel a lot better. I said, good. She's getting out of self. And so anyway, the next morning he called me, and he said, your new baby called. I said, really? Who's that? He said, well, the guy we saw yesterday. And I said, he didn't call me, Tim. He called you. That's your new baby. And he called me about 1 o'clock that afternoon, and he said, would you ride us to Duffy's? He's ready to go. And that's what took the man to Duffy's. And I'd like to tell you it ended up good, because it did. All right, one more little thing here on page 43. This doctor they're talking about here becomes very prominent in the history of California. And this doctor they're talking about, many doctors and psychiatrists agree. This guy's name was Dr. Percy Pollack. P-O-L-I-A-K. And the hospital they're working in is Bellevue, that famous New York hospital where a lot of those old alcoholics went to. He comes to California about 1939 or 40, and he's given the job of taking over the old Agnew State Hospital over some of the old times. We'll remember that it's closed now, over across the bay. And he ran the San Francisco General. And he got a good job, basically. He'd been exposed to AA, knew about them, and got hooked up with Ted C., which was the original guy that got the book from Mrs. Oram. I gave you that history earlier. And they together, he allowed Ted C. to talk to the psychiatric community. Ted had been in enough mental hospitals to be one. And, you know, it's like guys that go to 28-day treatment programs. I said, heck, you could run one by now. You know, you've been there enough time. You know exactly how to operate. So anyway, he was a big help to get meetings started in the early days in the San Francisco area. I just thought you'd like to know that guy. How many people in here are believers in God or a higher power or something? Good. We're going to check you out with this chapter. He's going to start in the preceding chapters, we agnostics. He says in the preceding, I got a joke for you. I want to start off. I like jokes. I never do that. Two older women in AA who had been together with very long time sobriety, and they'd been through everything together. They'd just been good friends, and they had buried their husbands together, and they'd helped to get the husbands sober together, and they'd gotten sober, and the whole family had gotten sober. Allah dog, Allah teen, Allah everything, you know, and everybody's doing the thing and everybody's happy, and so they ended up making a pact with each other. They were just desperately great friends, and I hope you find one like that in your life, because a good friend is something really great to have. And I have a lot of them nowadays, and nobody was talking to me when I ended up. But anyway, they made a pact, and they said, you know, if one of us dies before the other, if it's possible, we'll come back and tell the other one what it's like. And so Marjorie died, and she came back and said, wake up Nancy in the middle of the night. And she said, oh, Marjorie, how is it? She said, it's wonderful. She said, you know, it's just so great. All our old friends are there, you know, and we have the greatest meetings. And man, I mean, the love is so great. And, you know, Bill Wilson comes by and Lois, you know, and it's just, J.C. shows up once in a while. That's Jesus Christ, for you who wouldn't know. And they said, you know, I mean, God walks by. I mean, this is good stuff. And she had told her, she said, I got some good news for you and some bad news. And she said, well, what's the bad news? Said, you're the speaker tomorrow morning. So you may not be as anxious to go as you think you are. So in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. So what does he tell you from 44 back what the book is about? You've learned something about alcoholism. You've learned something about the first two steps. That's what he's working with you on. So he's trying to teach you here to be self-diagnosed alcoholic that Mike did so well a minute ago. That self, I have to admit, and one day I had to admit it. So we said we hope that we've made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic. Here is two, you don't need 44 questions, you don't need 20 questions, you only need to answer two. It says, if when you honestly, a conditional word, you might want to put a C over that, there are conditions in this program, want to, you find you cannot quit entirely. Well, let me measure that one. I have sincerely wanted to quit. I could get 28 days on guts, but I'd always go back to drinking. Or if when drinking, you had little control of the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. It's the closest the book will ever come to telling you whether you're an alcoholic or not. And I can match that. I know that statement. You have little control. Once I start to drink, I have little control over the amount I intend to drink because of that allergy of the body. I don't know about the allergy of the body until you told me. You are probably alcoholic. Step one. He hides step one from you. And now he's going to give you step two. In that case, you may be suffering from an illness, which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Excuse me. Step two. He also gives you steps back before that and more about alcoholism, but we won't go back there. To one of the theists and atheists that are agnostic, such an experience seems impossible. So he gives you the alternative. But to continue as he is means disaster, especially as an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And that is exactly what I am. I am an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, and I will die an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. God has restored me to sanity, but I will always have the allergy. So therefore, I can never pick up safely. I can drink today. I can't drink safely. So he says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death, step one, or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face, step two. But it isn't so difficult, a little promise. I want to put a P by it. About half our original fellowship was exactly that type. So half of the first 100, approximately, those figures vary, 50 of them were exactly like this. At first, some of us tried to avoid the issues. Issue hoping against hope that we were not true alcoholics. Won't do step one. But after a while, we had to face the fact we must find the spiritual basis of life or else. Step two. I'm caught between one and two. Perhaps it's going to be that way with you. But cheer up. Something like half of us thought we were atheists, agnostics. Our experience shows another promise, that you need not be disconcerted, which means to be upset. They're not going to drive you into the wall and then leave you there just to die. Now, here's a great line. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Philosophy. Name me a philosopher, anybody. Don't make a difference. Thank you. So philosophy is a way of life that if you read their way of life and you follow it, you should end up with some sort of success. There's been a lot of them around. A lot of them are alcoholics. A code of morals. 10 Commandments, a code of morals? Well, I couldn't live up to them anyway. If that makes any sense. Neither can anybody else. That's why our book says progress, not perfection here. It's a little more to the truth. But we found such codes that philosophy did not save us, no matter how much we've tried. I love the intellectuals. God, I love to hear the intellectuals come. I love that. College intellectual doctors who come to our program, and they just intellectualize. And you just have to go, yeah, keep on there, you know. Have a few more drinks, you'll make it. We could wish to be moral. We could wish to be philosophically covered. In fact, we could will these things with all our might, but the needed power wasn't there. No matter how many people here read self-help books? Oh, that'll do it, right? Good self-help book, that ought to do it, right? Anybody got interested in the book of the day, men are from Mars, women are from Venus? Did you ever try to figure out your relationships? Did anybody try that one out, you know? I mean, a lot of people write a lot of things. I mean, it's very interesting, you know. Or human, Dr. Phil. You ever watch Dr. Phil? I mean, God Almighty, that guy's good. Are human resources as marshaled by the will? This is your question for you, so you can revert these into questions. You have to ask yourself. You have to make this thing personal. Has my human will, has my human resources, everything that's in me, marshaled by the will, was it sufficient? No, it says they were not sufficient. They failed utterly. That's me. Everything I had working for me could not stop me from drinking. Self cannot overcome self. And that applies to any human being. Don't let people fool you. Everybody, there's no perfect people in this world. See, I came and thought everybody was perfect. I'm so self-centered, I can only think within myself. I can't even get out of self. We're going to talk a little more about that without help. Now he's going to lay out the problem. He writes always in a problem-solution manner. He'll give you the problem, then he'll give you the solution. Just like steps one and two. But he'll always write, he writes that way. And so when you catch on to the way he writes as you study your book, you're not going to get it all today. But as you study your book, you'll be able to go through and you'll pick these things up. So lack of power, that was our dilemma. Problem. That is the problem. Not only am I powerless over alcohol, but this implication is tremendous and scary. And where it takes a lot of alcoholics, it takes a lot to go to this place. I am powerless over people, places, and things. I myself have no power. And if you look at the St. Francis prayer, which was really not written by him, but it was written about his life by some other people. He knew he had no power. So he's asking God to let him be something. And the same thing applies here. I do not have any power. I do not work. I used to think I had power. It all failed. I told you sitting down here, I failed at everything I ever did. So he said, lack of power, that was our dilemma. And so he gives you the solution. We had to find a power by which we could live. Live. And live well. So a lot of people in the program say, I didn't know how to live. So that's right. That's right. So how to live. It had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how we define this power? Question. See, The way he writes, he will lead you. He's gone to legal school. He will lead you by his statements to the proper question that should end up in your mind. Okay, you got me convinced. I'm powerless. If I want to get a new life, I have to do something. And he tells me, then where do we find this power? So we go to the solution. Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself which will solve your problem. What problem? Oh, I got you scared now. Lack of power. It will solve that problem. Once it solves that problem, you can solve any problem with your power. Does that make sense? God is not limited, and this book does not limit it to alcohol. In the back, when we read in the back of the spiritual experience, it said problems. So our book is, if I can get this power into my life, and if I can, and this is not easy. Let me tell you, you can read this thing quickly, and it sounds like it's really easy. Because what I do if I don't have a God, I live on instincts. God gave me instincts. Most alcoholics are very familiar with instincts. I believe in God and live on instincts. Does that make sense? Which produces guilt. How's that? Dr. Phil don't know about that. That's what produces guilt. I get up the next day, I've got this set of morals, the Ten Commandments, and all the stuff I've got in me, and my belief system, but I can't live up to my belief system. Not because I'm an idiot, not because I'm stupid, not because I'm alcoholic. Because like all human beings, I don't have any power in my life. And so I have to live on my instincts because that's all I've got. So what are the instincts? Social instincts, sex instincts, security instincts. Did you ever see kids today who want $100 pair of tennis shoes to go to school in and refuse to go if they don't have them? That's social instinct. Man, they want to be like the other people down at the schoolhouse. I remember, I'm a farm kid, you know, off and on. But anyway, that means we've written a book, which means that we believe to be spiritual as well as moral. What is moral? The truth. Moral means the truth. What is the right or wrong of a given situation? And it means, of course, we're going to talk about, oh, don't do that in a meeting. Man, that's so, yeah. Page 19 tells us what we can talk about in meetings. We marked them when we went through it. But you try talking about it in AA today and see what happens. Unless you got a lot of time and you can give them the eye, you know what I mean? Here, difficulty arises with the agnostic. Many times we talk to the new man and watch his hopes rise as we discuss his alcoholic problem, and explain our fellowship. That's what we do. First, that's all. We got a fellowship, good people, society, people who found out they can't drink safely, and they get together and they stay sober. But his face falls when we speak of spiritual matters, especially when we mention God. For we reopened a subject which our man thought he'd neatly evaded or entirely ignored. Got first sponsor. He died on me. I know I won't give up once I get one. His name was Johnny Morrow, long dead now. Wonderful man. He was sober many years when I got him. He was so anxious he creaked when he walked. But he was great. And I knew he loved me. And so I asked him, and he didn't say a word. He had a cane, and he was kind of skinny, and I'm a big guy, and I'm running along beside him and said, John, I'll be a really good sponsor. Don't worry about me. I'll do everything you tell me to. I've had all I can stand, you know. I'm trying to convince him he ought to take me off. So we get to the car, and he hands me this card. It says, "Have big book, we'll travel Johnny Morrow." Kind of like the old days of Paladin on it, and a phone number, you know. And he turns and he looks me right dead in the eye and he said, "You believe in God, boy?" Oh, I was about ready to tell him my first lie. I mean, I wanted to lie so bad. Oh, God. Because I did not want him to think less of me. And I said, I wanted to tell him about my great Jewish experience, which was really my cousin got married to a Jewish girl in a synagogue. That's what that was about. That's all I knew about that one. I wanted to tell him about the time I got dipped in the Mormon church. None of this had worked. You know? And I said, yes, I do believe in God. And he said, then he says, if you believe in God, and I said, yeah, I believe in God. And I was going through my mind what to tell him. You know how we are. We're slick, we think. And I said, yes, I do believe in God. He said, then you must pray, mustn't you? Boy, he pinned me to the wall in a hot second. And I said, no, I don't pray, God. Because that's the truth, I don't. Didn't. And he went right, he didn't, like a bulldozer, man, he didn't back up a minute. He said, no relief, and the crowd's out there, the bus on, come on, we got to go. And he said, why don't you pray if you believe in God? And I told the truth for the first time in my life, and I said to him, do you really want to know? And he said, yeah, I do. I said, I'm 7 years old. My mother remarried when I was 6 to a drunk. She's pregnant with my sister, who's a year younger than me. And I said, he is just beating the holy hell out of her. And she is pregnant, and I'm screaming and hollering, and if I'd have been bigger, I'd have bit him. I don't know what I'd have done. You know, I'd have done something. And nobody come, and I'm looking for help in the hallways of this apartment, and nobody's coming, and I can't call on the phone, and I'm just terrified. And and eventually I thought about God, and I prayed, and he didn't show up. I'm a seven-year-old boy. And I figured, I didn't quit believing in God, I just figured God didn't do that work anymore. I just figured he didn't do that kind of work. Because I knew about God, because I've been to Sunday school. You know, and I've had a God belief all my life. I believe it came with me from someplace else. I've always had it. I've never believed any other way. I think it's easier to believe in God than it is not to believe in God. I'll tell you that one right off the bat, you know. And so that's how I got started in this program with this man. He said, well, what I want you to do when you get back down there to that place you're hanging out in, that band indicates to me how much you know. Hell, he was tough. And he said, I want you to pray. And I know you're probably in a room. He said, that door swing both ways. What's keeping you there? It's not you. You've never been able to do it before. It's not that group of people. It's what we call God. And he said, I want you to lay your head on the pillow tonight, and I want you to say to God, thank you for keeping me sober today. And then in the morning, so I want you to throw your shoes way up under your bed because you're going to be embarrassed and there's going to be 4 or 5 guys in the same room you're in. And I want you to get down on your knees to that bed like you're looking for your shoes. And so you're not too embarrassed of God. You can say to God, help me stay sober today. And then he hit me with it. And he said, and don't talk to somebody you don't know very long. I mean, that's devastating. Because the truth of it is, I'm really more of an agnostic when it comes to God than I'm a believer. My experiences tell me that. Even though I would tell you that I've always believed in God. It was my saving grace when I hit that bottom in 1985 and when I found incomprehensible demoralization and when I decided that my manhood was gone because I couldn't drink like a man anymore. Because I couldn't control it. I hadn't been able to control it for years. And I had a .38 up against the side of my head and couldn't pull the trigger. So I've been to those kind of bottoms. And I've had that kind of drinking that goes on with people who drink from come to the pass out. And eventually you have to self-detox. And I don't even know what self-detox is. I can't even rub the alcohol out of my... I'm drinking vodka. Vodka is the great drinker of the last... of the alcoholic people. Great stuff, man. Because it's about all it would stay anymore. White wine, cold beer, and I'd have to start on the beer. So I like to throw a little story in once in a while for you.